We're down there.
Call to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. It is Tuesday, May 5th. Happy Cinco de Mayo. It is 1 o'clock p.m. So we're going to start off with, yes, and since Representative Brayfield's not the only one not here, I think we'll actually jump into that work session first, and then we can suspend the rules to let him vote. So I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 7A. And Patrick, you yes. want to give us, I was about to say, something else.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 7A, the committee heard this bill last Tuesday. It's the bill that requires the Department of Administrative Services to procure or supervise procurement of information technology goods and services for the Oregon Health Authority. The bill has a minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact. The Senate floor vote was 29-0, and there are no amendments, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. And with that, I will entertain a motion. Representative Buehler, do you want to give a motion? Do we have a script for that?
Madam Speaker, I move to put forth a due pass recommendation on Senate Bill 7A.
Representative Buehler has moved that we would send Senate Bill 7A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, Debbie, please call the roll.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Representative Hovey?
Aye.
Representative McClain?
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Buehler?
Yes.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Excused.
And Chair Fagan?
Yes. All right, with that, is there anyone who wanted to carry that on the floor?
I think Representative Rayfield
would. I think that would be a great idea. Representative Rayfield will carry that. Okay. And just really quickly, colleagues, I neglected to introduce Patrick Brennan is our new committee administrator. Wendy, as you know, a lot of the committee services directors, they're only here during session, so they have to kind of be looking for other jobs. And she was able to get another job. So she left definitely a turnkey operation, met with us the last couple of weeks to make sure there's a smooth transition, so we should not have any problems. But this is Patrick, and he's going to be assisting us as committee administrator for the duration of the session. So welcome.
Thank you.
And
good luck.
Yeah. With that,
I've had tougher chairs before. Representative Holding.
With that, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 278A. And do you want to give us a description of the bill? And whoever wants to be the first person to come forward on that, go ahead and come.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 278A voids payday loans, title loans, and consumer finance loans of $50,000 or less. If at the time the loan in question is made, the person making the loan was not licensed to issue the loan, it prohibits unlicensed persons or their successors, assignees, or affiliates from collecting, receiving, or retaining principal, interest, fees, or charges related to or in connection with payday loans, title loans, or consumer finance loans of $50,000 or less. The measure would become operative 91 days after its effective date and has an emergency clause. There's no fiscal or revenue impact, and there was no amendments to this bill. It did come with a Senate floor vote of 18 to 12, and those votes are listed on the staff measure summary if you're curious.
Thank you very much. Go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Tappan. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Mm-hmm. We are the largest consumer protection agency within the state. Next to me is Richard Blackwell. He's our legislative liaison on behalf of the division. And we appreciate the opportunity to come before you today, and thank you for your time. As you heard from Mr. Brennan, this bill has gone through the Senate. You see an A on it, so we have worked on it in the Senate to make some minor changes to it. Mr. Cosgrove and our office worked together to come up with what we think was a tweaking of it or fine-tuning of it to make it a little clearer about the one issue around licensing. This is a issue that I want to be careful in how we address this. This is around a legal concept of saying a contract would be void from the start, and it sounds like it's a very legalistic matter. But what we really are bringing this in front of this committee for is because we want to address providing consumers some self-help, providing them some protection from unscrupulous offshore payday lenders. Now, many of you probably are familiar with payday lending, and it at one time was a very popular form of lending within the state of Oregon. You could see them everywhere. In fact, someone did an analysis and determined there were more payday lenders than McDonald's franchises in the state of Oregon. That has changed, but we still have a number of licensed payday lenders. And in your packet of materials, I believe Mr. Brennan's distributed letters that we received from three licensed payday lenders in the state of Oregon. These people have a standard by which they have to comply. There are standards in terms of their interest rates that they have to meet. That's 36% per annum rate. And they also have a restriction on how often they can turn a loan over or renew a loan. And so there are standards they have to apply to. What we have seen, though, is there is a black market of payday lending that goes on, and it's through the Internet. And unfortunately, Internet payday lenders are not licensed, with just two exceptions. And these unlicensed ones do not adhere to the law. And so we are seeing payday loans that may run from 5 to 600% per annum, and they are renewed without any limitation. But the real challenge is, contrary to what you may think of as a traditional payday loan where somebody would get a loan prior to payday and they would write an advance check that was post-dated, and then at the time that the date came up, that check would be used to repay the loan. What we have today is a situation where these online payday lenders are using something known as an ACH, and the ACH is a means of withdrawing money from a bank account owned by the consumer. And so the consumer will authorize the ACH. That's the condition of it taking on this loan. Unfortunately, once that ACH is authorized, these unscrupulous companies will take money out repeatedly and excessively. So a typical payday loan will be somewhere in the neighborhood from $350 to $1,000. And we will see people paying fees in excess of $2,000. And so in many instances, the principal that they receive has been more than exceeded by the interest and fees and so forth. And the real challenge is, once the ACH is in place, they can't get out from under the ACH. And so these companies keep pulling money out and pulling money out. Finally, the only advice we can give to many of the consumers is, you have to close that account and you have to start over. Well, you can imagine the hassle factor that is. And so that's a real destructive method for engaging in a short-term loan. And then what we are seeing on top of that is many of these companies are affiliating with collection agencies and then coming in to try and collect uncollected interest and principal. And so they will go in, and as you probably are aware, on small loans like this, it's going to be collected through the courts, but it's going to be collected through small claims court, where there is no legal representation for the most part. And so all too often we'll see people get then jammed up in those courts and more, for the most part, don't even take the steps to protect themselves. So this bill is designed to provide two protections. One, we say that the loan is void. It is void from the outset. It means it's an illegal loan. In theory, they're not allowed to collect it. So the consumer could go to the bank and show that this was an illegal loan and have the underlying ACH canceled. Second thing is, it could go into court at a small claims hearing on the collection efforts and, again, show this was an illegal activity, and that should nullify the collection efforts as well. So we think this is a very prominent way to help consumers obtain self-help. Now, we have, as I said, licensed consumer finance lenders and licensed payday lenders, and there was some concern that, as the bill was originally drafted, should their license lapse through inadvertence or a mistake, that they could find themselves making loans that would have been deemed illegal, and therefore they couldn't collect them. Well, there's some mechanisms in place. One mechanism is that the fact is that under the law currently, a payday lender or a consumer finance lender's license doesn't lapse. It continues in effect until such time as the state takes affirmative steps to revoke that license. So they can't really find themselves in that position. But just, if you will, to make sure that we've got everything in place, working with Mr. Cosgrove, we adopted language that made that clear, that if through inadvertence or mistake a license lapsed, that they'd still be able to collect that. So we think we've taking care of the concerns that the industry had. Before I take questions, I would just like to point out the letters you received. Vice Chair Buehler suggested, you know, it would be helpful to hear what the legitimate industry had to say about this. And so we thought that was really a great suggestion. So we've brought these letters on. We apologize. They're not on letterhead. They were sent to us through the Internet. So this is how we received them. But I would just point out the one you may see from Randy Saislin. I think he does a good job of summarizing how the industry sees the situation with the offshore online creditor lenders. To whom it may concern, as president of Wolf Creek Financial, he says, I strongly encourage the passage of Senate Bill 278, and then goes on to say which voids the payday and title loans. And if you read the rest of it, you can see that he feels like the legitimate businesses are really at a disadvantage, and we recognize that, and that really the consumers are being taken advantage of through a lack of understanding. We have taken time to try and educate. We had a campaign in the holiday months in December of 2013 where we tried to address these concerns. We had television ads, radio ads, even ads on buses and so forth. We wanted to educate consumers, don't put yourself in a bind. In other words, use licensed people if you have to borrow money for the holidays. And although it was well received, unfortunately, I think people still respond pretty knee-jerk like when they get to the internet. And so what we want to do is try and give them one more tool there. I think that's all I have. Mr. Blackwell, is there anything you'd like to add?
Just for the record, Vice Chair Rayfield and members of the committee, I'm Rick Blackwell with the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. I think all I wanted to mention was that Sybil Head from the Oregon Law Center did want to testify in person. Unfortunately, she couldn't be here on another matter, and so her written testimony is in OLIS. Other than that, I think I'll just turn it back over to David.
Questions? Thank you, Chair. So it sounds like you've said it several times about this is an internet problem, and I'm trying to read, and maybe you can direct me to where in the bill. I don't see that it's spelled out to internet specific, or is it?
Vice Chair Buehler and Representative Stark, it is not specific to that, but the reality is that's how most of this activity takes place. In this day and age, bricks and mortars are not popping up unless they're getting licensed, and so the alternative is the internet. But we haven't expressly stated the internet. Presumably, if somebody decided to open up an illegal, unlicensed activity in Oregon, we would pursue them as well.
Yeah. Follow-up? Yeah, follow-up. So a couple scenarios, and I'm trying to make see if this falls into this. Let's say I see a small piece of land next door to my house, and it goes on the market for $30,000, and I want to borrow money from a brother. And I say, hey, look, I'll give you 5% straight interest for $30,000 for 2 years, and you know you'll be the first on this loan, so I can buy it right now and just do it. This would prevent him from being able to do that without a license?
Vice Chair Buehler and Representative Stark, no, there are other exclusions from that. So the definition of a consumer finance lender or a payday lender, it will exclude certain activities. So, for instance, a bank, a depository, if you will, mm-hmm. is excluded. There are other exclusions as well. And, frankly, presumably your brother wouldn't be in the business of making these loans either.
Right. So, but it mentions a title loan. Am I misunderstanding what a title loan is? So in that scenario, could, without going through a bank, just going straight through escrow, could somebody, brother or non-brother, loan me $30,000 to buy a piece of property?
Representative Buehler and Representative Stark, title loans are expressly defined for car titles.
Okay.
When somebody takes a car title in lieu of any other collateral, and they make a short-term loan on that car. And so that's the only way we use the word title loan. So the real estate loan you're talking about is mortgage lending, and it's secured by real estate. And again, your brother A isn't in the business, and B, we would exclude a one-time event like that. So yes, he could make that loan to you without any fear of running across state limitation.
Yeah, one more follow-up before I hand it off. This bill, is this retroactive? So as soon as it's in place, things, you know, people have borrowed money and they would no longer have to pay that back?
Representative Buehler, Vice Chair Buehler, excuse me, and Representative Stark, no, it's not retroactive. It goes forward. Now, it has an emergency clause, but that's just to give us the authority to go, give us the opportunity to put things in place.
Thanks. So, our as a result of this bill, will all
payday lending have to be licensed through DCBS that takes place in Oregon?
Vice Chair Bueller, Representative Holvey, all payday lending that doesn't meet the standards within ORS Chapter 82. Can't remember the number off the top of my head, Rick. You know,
725A.
Well, not 725A. That's the licensing standard, but there's a requirement for. Here it is. ORS Chapter 82, yes. 8210, 8220, 82025. If the loan is of a certain amount or if the loan is above a certain interest rate, then, yes, they would have to be licensed to make those loans.
Pull up.
Yes, sir.
So does that take care of out-of-state tribal lending as well?
Well, that's a nice can of worms question. Representative Bueller and Representative Holvey. Vice Chair Bueller and Representative Holby. Tribal lending is an interesting conundrum in that the tribes are considered a sovereign nation. And the tribes, if they authorized a corporation within a tribe to engage in payday lending, are not subject to state law and arguably may or may not be subject to federal law. We think they are subject to federal law. What we find is a lot of the tribal lending doesn't do the job properly. Many of the people who claim to be engaged in tribal lending are, in fact, individuals who set themselves up for that. But it's a case-by-case basis. So we can't stop all of that. Unfortunately, that's going to be something the federal government would have to step in and do. But we think in many instances, if somebody claims to be a tribal member, it behooves us to go in and check that before we just assume that's correct.
So, just to make sure that I understand this correctly, if I were to go get a loan from one of these people who wasn't licensed, and let's say I got a $25,000 loan, I put the money in my bank account, I spend it at that time, then I go back and say, hey, wait a second, this loan wasn't valid. You basically have to forgive this debt, if you will, or it's not valid. Is that my understanding? I mean, just of how this would work as a punishment mechanism for loaning without a license.
Vice Chairs Bueller and Vice Chairs Rayfield, at the very top of the statement, that is correct, but let's drill down a little bit. First of all, nobody is making a $25,000 loan on the internet. They won't do it because there's no underwriting. They're making some assumptions that they're making a small enough loan that they can afford to take the chance that they may not recover as much. And in reality, as I think we pointed out, or you may have seen in the previous testimony, most of these loans are small enough that they're making more than what their principal is back on interest rates, interest earned and fees and so forth. So that's possible, but highly unlikely. Second of all, the law already exists. The courts in Oregon, as you well know, are both courts of law and courts of equity. Equity would say that someone should not be unjustly enriched. And so in a situation like you, it might be incumbent upon the company to come forward and say, you know, we're going to come in and say, wait a minute, Judge, we would like to be put back to our original position. Yes, this was an illegal loan, but this person's been unjustly enriched. So just let's go back to a rescission state of mind and just push the parties back to their original positions. So whatever fees you paid, you would be entitled to, but whatever you received would be required to be paid back.
Just a follow-up.
Yeah, follow-up.
So, I mean, the way I read this, that's not the case, that the loan would be void, and essentially this legislation would counter basically all of the equity remedies, you know, under that, you know, the unjust enrichment. And that's the way I read. And I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing, but that's the way I read the language of this, that essentially the consumer finance loan is void. And so to me, just from a plain reading of it, an equitable remedy wouldn't be available to the person loaning. And I know that this isn't necessarily the main circumstance that, you know, we're talking about, but I'm trying to really understand. And there could be an argument, quite frankly, for making it void and not having an equitable remedy because they aren't following, they're not licensed and they're not following the law. But with that said, it's just how I read the law. You have a different take on that. Can you help me understand that a little better?
Well, again, Vice Chair Bueller and Vice Chair Rayfield, my read is this is contractual, and although it's a contractual, it would be legal as opposed to equitable. I don't know that we could exclude equity. I don't know that we could tell the court equitably you can't do anything. Yeah. I think that's a possibility. Again, I think this is an interesting discussion and one that we've had in our office and one that we would, you know, have among lawyers and law students. In reality, I don't think that's the case. I just don't see it happening. The people we're out to protect are the hundreds of people we've got complaints on that went in to get a $500 loan, and the next thing you know, they're out $2,500. Mm-hmm. And now someone's digging in with a collection effort to pick up the last few dollars remaining on the table.
Is the intent to leave the equitable remedy on the table? And if so, would this be better written if we added in another paragraph just to make it very clear? Because if you don't make it clear, this is going to be left up to the courts, which would then cost somebody later on, you know, some time and money.
Vice Chairs Bueller and Rayfield, I think you maybe step back further what your original proposition was. Do we want to say as a policy matter, we don't want this activity going on? If you're going to engage in illegal conduct in Oregon, this is a consequence. Just like we don't want other illegal activity, we're not going to carve out a situation for those people that foolishly did something they shouldn't. Again, I firmly believe that people engaged in this have their eyes wide open. They know exactly what they're doing. To the extent that's possible, we in fact provided an amendment previously to address just that, put the language of the equitable remedy in the law. In consultation with members here in the room, Mr. Cosgrove, for instance, he felt like it was a redundancy, and I was convinced that if that's the case, then let's not state in the law what the courts inherently have the equitable power to do.
And just the last follow-up, because the real question is, if we don't want it, then we could put it in here to avoid, you know, unnecessary litigation. If we do want to have the equitable remedy in there, again, we could put it in there. And so I was asking what your initial intent was.
Vice Chairs Bueller and Rayfield, our intent was to make it void.
Okay.
Period.
No equitable remedy.
Okay. No.
Question. How many licensed online consumer lenders are there now that can do business in Oregon?
Vice Chair Bueller, I believe there's two online licensed payday lenders. And there are probably somewhere between 65 and 70 bricks and mortar payday lenders.
And this legislation would do nothing to prohibit their continued business activities in the state of Oregon?
Vice Chair Bueller, absolutely not. In fact, if anything, I think what we would do is put them in a more balanced situation where we make them more attractive and level the playing field, as I think one of the commentators in one of the letters said.
And as Chris, it looked like a straight party line vote in the Senate. What was the source of opposition?
Vice Chair Bueller, actually it was the numbers are straight party line, but it turned out there was one Republican voted for it and one Democrat that voted against it. So it wasn't quite straight, but pretty similar. We're not clear about that. It's our understanding is that there may have been some discussions about certain bills and activity that the Republican Party had some concerns about. We had conversations. We were just told that they had concerns in general. It wasn't about the bill or the fairness of the bill.
Okay. Any other questions? Yeah,
Representative McClain. Well, I think you answered two of my questions, but my last one is, I mean, we're trying to stop fees and a process that really is out of hand for the consumer because they don't have evidently all of this paperwork up front to really review or understand what they're getting themselves into. And so, I mean, that's the purpose, that's the problem, that these folks are doing business illegally and they're causing consumer issues because of the kind of fees that they're actually putting in place. And so to me, if that's the goal and the language in front of that of us does that, well then, you know, it's one that I would want to vote for. And so I just want to make sure in my mind that what you've said to us today is you think that this will stop them from acting without at least having a license or going through a review with the state of Oregon.
Vice Chairs Buehler and Vice Chairs Rayfield, I wish it would stop them. We'd like to at least try and send a message to them that there's a risk if you choose not to do anything about this. Right now, these are considered voidable, which means that, there's limitations on it. Not to digress too much, but for instance, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the new federal agency that's comparable to the FTC, except it engages in financial issues on behalf of consumers, we brought to them a couple of cases that we thought were worth them taking on because they were cases we could not get to somebody where somebody was offshore. They declined to take them because of the language of the law in Oregon. They said it's not void, it's not illegal per se, it's subject to being voided, and therefore they wouldn't take them on. Not that they're going to take on a lot of these, but I just think that helps provide some clarity. But to get back to your point, really what this will do is give the consumers some protection after the fact.
Okay.
As you know, if you go online, oftentimes you'll get a lot of really minuscule print on something, and you're supposed to go through and digest that and then click I agree. So it probably has some level of disclosure, although it's still illegal, some level of disclosure, but I think most of these people are unable to absorb all that, similar to what most of us go through when we buy a car or buy a home. It's just more than they're willing to process or able to process. There are a lot of unscrupulous companies. I don't know that the fact that they can't collect will stop them. What I'd like to do is tell consumers, here's a remedy you may have available to you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is there really a remedy? Because if these are online operators, do you have the ability to if, like you said, they're soaking my ACH, whatever, just going to hit in my bank account. Is there a way to go back at them and get that money back? I mean, if this law weren't to pass, don't you have remedies to go after someone who says they're going to bill me $500 and bills me $2,500?
Vice Chairs Buehler and Rayfield, in theory, there would be, but in fact, the same challenge we face is going and finding these phantom operations. If you've got someone, so they're in Nevis, they're in Malta, they're in the Isle of Man, so anywhere in the Caribbean or anywhere in South Pacific, lots of places they pop up. And the reality is they've got a location somewhere in the United States, but to get to and pierce the corporate identity, the corporate veil, is a real challenge. And so just to get them served, and two, to be able to bring them in front of the court and effectively do anything with that, even if you were to sue them and get a default judgment on behalf of yourself as a consumer, then you'd have to do something to collect on that. And I think the reality is most people are going to say, lesson learned, we hope, and suffer for that. But in theory, you're right. In fact, I don't think it would happen.
So there isn't a remedy now, practically speaking, nor will there be after this passes, then. You're just not going to be able to get to most of these, right? I mean.
Yes, Vice Chairs Buehler and Rayfield. Most consumers won't be able to get to them, just like we're really challenged to get to them. What it does, though, is give them some avenue if people persist. And I think it may give them some leverage when they go to their bank to say, this is an illegal loan. This ACH should be canceled here and now, as opposed to allowing them to keep hitting that ACH till you finally just say enough, close the account, take the money out, and open a new account.
Yep. Any further questions? Resume Hobley.
Just to clarify, I think I know the answer to this, but what constitutes one of these lenders to be required to be licensed in Oregon is, especially for these internet, is not really where they are, is that they're doing business with somebody in Oregon?
Vice Chairs Rayfield and Buehler, absolutely correct. That we say you're an Oregonian and you're doing business with an Oregonian, or if you're drawing money out of an Oregon account. And so conceivably, if you set up an account, but you're now in Arizona, but your account's still with a bank in Oregon, we would deem that to be an Oregon transaction.
Can we follow up?
Yep, follow up.
And just one more, not to drag up old conversations, but could DCBS by itself require for its licensees the beneficial ownership of some of these corporate entities so you would be able to pierce that veil and figure out who they are?
Vice Chairs Rayfield and Buehler, part of the problem, I think, is we might be able to require that, but our effect would be within the boundaries of the state. So, A, first of all, it would be subject to Oregon law. But, B, for most of these corporations, if they're incorporated in Nevis or the Isle of Man or something like that, we could require it, but we could never make that be the requirement for their locale. And so, again, what we might be able to do is say, well, if you engage in this conduct without setting up certain standards in terms of your corporation, you can't do business in Oregon. I don't think these companies actually would care, because we've already told them they can't do business in Oregon until they comply with the current standards for payday lending.
So, just, but what about the ones that do license themselves with DCBS in Oregon? Or could you request that kind of information, or do you request that kind of beneficial ownership information?
Yes, Vice Chair and Representative Holby, we get information when they get licensed. We find out who the principals are or the shareholders of more than 20% interest in the corporation. And, in fact, we do background checks on those people. We determine that they're of sound financial standards and that they have no criminal history that would give us concern. And so that already takes place.
So on the licensed ones, that happens?
Correct.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry, I'm back to my original question. I'm trying to figure out, as I'm reading the bill, page 1, verses 10 through, or lines 10 through 16, you know, where it talks about a consumer finance loan. When I go look up the Oregon definition of consumer finance loan, it says a consumer finance loan means a loan or line of credit that is unsecured or secured by personal or real property and that has a periodic payment in terms longer than 60 days. So I'm still trying to figure out how this would not include my friend loaning me $30,000 to buy a piece of property. Because this is saying it could be, you know, Oregon law here defines consumer finance loan as being able to be secured by real property. And so I'm concerned that there's this consequence of private party lending that people do and that this is going to all of a sudden cut that out.
Vice Chair Bueller and Representative Stark, again, though, the definition of consumer finance loan is meant to define the circumstances in which a business, someone that's actually holding themselves out in the business of making these types of loans, needs to be licensed. And so you can still separate out when someone is lending for various non-commercial reasons, as the example you've illustrated, and where someone is operating either an internet presence or a storefront where they're constantly and habitually making these kind of loans.
But if I had $30,000 sitting around and I wanted to loan it to friends periodically and make, you know, 5-6% interest on it, you're saying I can keep doing that? I don't have $30,000 sitting around, but like the way I read this, this would keep that sort of transaction from happening.
Vice Chairs Bueller and Rayfield, Representative Stark, the fact is that this isn't changing that circumstance. You're already either required to get licensed or you're not. I don't believe you are. I don't have the advantage of having the ORS in front of me. I'd be happy to come back and address that with you, but I'm pretty comfortable in telling you that a one-time event between friends or a family member is not required to be licensed. If, as you say, you periodically do that, well, then that may be a different circumstance, and I'm happy to sit down and talk with you about that. But this doesn't change the requirements for who has to be licensed as a payday lender or a consumer finance lender and who does. As I said earlier, there are a number of exemptions from the requirement of being licensed. I'm sure I could point that out to you. I just don't have it in front of me.
Further questions? Okay. If none, then I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 278A and open public hearing on Senate Bill 250. Thank you, gentlemen.
I'll give a rundown, Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you.
I think Senate Bill 250 makes permissive the provision of educational financial aid to beneficiaries of the Department of Veterans Affairs. It amends outdated language related to World War II Memorial in Salem, repeals outdated statutes, which are listed in the background in the staff measure summary, and has an emergency clause and would take effect upon passage and signature by the governor. There's no amendment to this measure. It has no fiscal or revenue impact, and the Senate floor vote was 30-0.
Thank you. Ms. Skillman, thank you. And guess.
And Molly.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Buehler, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laurie Skillman. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I'm here before you today about our bill that's a housekeeping bill for the agency. We have three Oregon revised statute chapters that we have authority over. It's 406, 7, and 8. So we went through all of those to see what kinds of things needed cleanup, what kinds of things were outdated, obsolete, and this bill just kind of cleans up those statutes. And I'll just kind of briefly go over a couple of examples. The first one is, as you know, we've built the World War II memorial that was dedicated last June on the Capitol grounds. And there's a provision in our statutes that calls for a task force on that World War II memorial. The memorial is built, task force is completed, let's get rid of that language. My personal favorite, though, is in 408-750, which requires a county judge not to sentence a veteran to the poorhouse. Now, the last poorhouse is Edgefield that's now a McMinimans.
That might be beneficial.
Yeah.
Sounds like a sign me up.
And I went through and I researched how long it had the county poorhouses been obsolete, how long has it been since they were closed, and it was in the early 50s. So that particular provision is about 65 years old, and I thought maybe we could clean that one out. So there are a number of things in there, or provisions that were put in the statute that never got funding, or like a small business repair loan, was funded at one point but hasn't been funded for 6 years, like the Campus Veteran Service Officers. So all of these are just kind of cleanup provisions in our statutes to repeal statutes or to amend them so that they work. The one that amends it so that it works is we provide educational financial aid. And if you read the statute, it says we are required to provide financial aid to veterans for education if they apply for it and meet, of course, the requirements. But it requires us to do it regardless of whether or not we have money. So, you know, just in an abundance of caution, we just change that so that we may provide this if there are funds that are dedicated to that or appropriated to that activity. So it really is a pure housekeeping cleanup bill. And if you have any questions about any of that, I'm happy to answer that.
Questions? Representative Klein?
Well, in the examples that you gave, they were so different. The very first one was, you know, the program doesn't exist any longer. They're not there. And that makes all the sense in the world. And then you gave an example of where there could be a possibility of helping, but there's just not a budget this year or in the last 6 years, possibly. And so I feel like those are really different scenarios. And so I wondered what was your rule of thumb when you were looking at the budgetary items? If it had been funded 5 years ago, did you leave it in? If it was 6 years ago, did you take it out? What was your criteria when it was funding issues?
Vice Chair Buehler, Representative McLean, it was that the last time it was funded was at least two sessions ago. So it wasn't in this last year's budget for the 2013-15, and it wasn't in the 2011 through 13 budget. So if it's gone through those two budget cycles, then it, you know.
Okay. Then a follow-up.
Follow-up?
The follow-up would just be this. It seems to me like sometimes, I mean, there's a lot of things on the books that haven't had budgets in many, many departments for years and years and years. But they may need to be on the books because they're a responsibility that we have legally or environmentally or whatever other reason. And so it just seems that if those are going to be taken out and this is going to be voted on and voted out, that do you have a notification process to either send that information back to a committee that would care about, like the Veterans Committee, like the Legislative Veterans Committee, so that they would know that if we want to do this again, not only do we have to fund it, but we have to actually put it back into statute?
Representative Buehler, Representative McLean, none of these, the provisions that we're repealing, and let me describe them to you because they don't have a long term impact or a long term consequence that would have some sort of a ripple effect down historically down the road. The Campus Veteran Service Officer is a good example of that. We currently have county veteran service officers that are employed by the county that provide help for veterans to go after federal veterans benefits from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs and help them with any of those kinds of benefits and with community resources, nonprofit resources, and all the state benefits through our Oregon state statutes. The Campus Veteran Service Officer Program was a program that was developed by the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. They wanted it. It would be to place those kinds of people who would be veteran service officers who need to be accredited, by the way. We train and accredit them onto campuses. They were ODVA employees, which we sent out as kind of a circuit rider kind of concept. The legislature said, fine, you want to do it, you can pay for it out of your home loan program. And the department said, fine, we'll do a pilot program on that. So they did the pilot program on that, and they came back and said, we did a pilot program on that. We would like to have permanent funding from that from the legislature. And the legislature said, thanks, but no thanks. So that program's been disbanded. I don't see any need for that to come back. We have these we believe that kind of activity needs to be with the counties, in the counties. The counties get funding through ODVA, through our budget process. Half of the money that we spend on veteran services goes to the counties. So that's an example. There's no impact, it was kind of a one-time concept. That particular program, the educational aid program, it's a program that we have. We get money for it. We just didn't want to be in a position where we would have to somehow come up with the funding for that if the legislature didn't appropriate monies for that. So we just change it to you shall provide this education to you may provide it if there's funding. So normally, I don't know why this bill came to this particular committee, but it is government effectiveness. All of our bills went through veterans, so they're aware of it. This came from Senate Veterans Committee, and those veterans committees would know about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate all those comments.
Sure, sure.
You know, I mean, I'm new, and so I get to still ask new questions, right? And the situation is that sometimes it just feels like if there's no process for what a criteria would be when you start taking things out of statute, that maybe there should be, or at least there should be some understanding that there's a possibility of a process, because otherwise it just, you're here for a while, I'm here for a while, and things happen, you know, a certain way when we're here, and then all of a sudden there's no process if we leave, and they don't have your history or institutional history or whatever. So I don't think it's a bad or uninformed question I was asking. I was just looking for process, and I was looking for criteria to try and figure out what your thinking pattern had been when you decided to do this. So I thank you for that.
Certainly.
Any further questions? I have a newbie question then, if you would humor me. What was the origin of this bill? Why did you take on this project?
Vice Chair Buehler, members of the committee, I started at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs about a year and a half ago as their senior policy advisor. And as part of that process, I reviewed all of the internal policies and all of the statutes and went through them with a fine-tooth comb. I'm an attorney. So having things in statute that don't make sense or that are 70 years old or that refer to poor houses was, you know, it seems like a lot of times laws are passed, bills are passed, the statutes just keep growing. Yeah. And to take a comprehensive view and to see what's necessary, what's not, what's dead wood, and clean it up so that it's so that every part of that statute makes sense. So we initiated the bill, and so it was through the governor.
Okay. Well, my hat's off to you. I wish more agencies would do this sort of work, and it's something we've talked about on this committee. Have you also taken that fine-tooth comb to your administrative rules in the agency? That's something we've discussed here.
Yes, Vice Chair Buehler. That is also, you know, within my scope and within my responsibilities. The administrative rules, in my mind, need to be reviewed by an agency comprehensively on kind of a 3 to 5 year basis. Anytime there is a legislative change, it's just like if you open up a statute, if you open up an administrative rule, then deal with that. It's on the list, sir.
Well, you may not be aware, and few are, but by law, they're supposed to be done every 5 years.
Yes. Oh, yes, sir.
I think it's not commonly done, it's unfortunately.
Vice Chair Buehler, I have done that at 3 agencies. No. So.
Thank you.
It's kind of my thing.
Thank you. I wish more would. Any other questions?
Just a comment. As not a newbie, I was going to say Ms. Gilman is no stranger to agencies. This isn't the only agency she's worked for in the past, so I know she's been through this before.
Great.
Nice to see you.
Any other questions? If none, close the hearing on Senate Bill 250.
Mr. Chair, I think it was suggested earlier that because the committee voted on Senate Bill 7.
That Representative Rayfield would carry the bill and not vote on it?
Yes. Or there was some discussion about maybe suspending the rules.
Can I get a motion to suspend the rules?
Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules to allow Representative Rayfield to vote on Senate Bill 7A.
Representative Holvey makes motion to suspend the rules to allow Representative Rayfield to vote on Senate Bill 7A. Any opposition? Hearing none.
The rules are suspended.
Rules are suspended.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
Right, so, thank you.
Yeah. And by the way, you're carrying the bill.
Oh, by the way.
I didn't make that decision. Yeah. It was, of course, our chair's decision. So. But somebody did suggest it.
Somebody.
It was a conspiracy. Yes.
All right. Any other business?
No. That completes our business for the day, Mr. Chair.
Then I'll bring to a close May 5th, 2015, House Committee on Consumer Protection, Government Effectiveness.